Good evening, everyone, and welcome back. I'm George Knapp, filling in for Art Bell, broadcasting to you live from Las Vegas. I'm sitting here in the studio all by myself, and I sure hope nothing goes wrong because I'm really winging it here. But I think that you're going to enjoy the next couple of hours. I've got a couple of special guests, guys I've known for a long time. In fact, it's 17 years ago this month, I met these two guys who told me quite a story. A story that changed the course of my professional life, had a lot of effects on my personal life. A story that basically put Area 51 on the map. I mean, 17 years ago, the only people that knew about Area 51 were the folks who had worked there or the folks who lived outside near the base. And now, as we know, it's known all over the world. The cottage industry, movies and books and TV shows and trinkets and Christmas ornaments and ashtrays, you name it. It also created, this story created quite a controversy in ufology, one that continues to this day. You should see the emails that I've been getting, hundreds of them over the past 2 days when we announced that these two guests were going to be joining me tonight. Some of them supportive, some of them very critical, but we're going to tackle both viewpoints tonight. The two guys are Bob Lazar and Gene Huff, and welcome to Coast, guys.
Thanks, George.
Hey, George.
Bob Lazar, of course, is president of United Nuclear, his own scientific research and development company looking into cutting-edge technologies. He sells a lot of retail scientific equipment and supplies through this company on the Internet. Gene Huff is his buddy, his confidant. He's known Lazar since the mid-1980s. He knew him before, during, and after he was in this flying disc reverse engineering program at S4 near Area 51. Gene also wrote the videotape, the Lazar tape, and excerpts from the government Bible. He's written a screenplay about he and Bob's adventures in Dreamland Chronicles. And these two guys have known this story from the beginning. They've not only known it, they've lived it. Bob, I'm going to start with not the Area 51 stuff, but some other dramatic developments that have happened in your life in just the last couple of weeks. Let's just jump into it without a lot of background explanation. What's happened?
Well, boy, that's a long story.
Give me the headline.
I'll give it to you in kind of a nutshell. And unfortunately, there's some of it I can't talk about, and that's for legal reasons, because now this is turning into a... anyway. Oh, a few years ago, we were raided here by a SWAT team, along with a few other government agencies. That we really haven't identified. And basically, they handcuffed my wife and I, went through everything in the house, confiscated our computers, and even took the trash cans that we typically shred catalogs and things of that sort and use for packing material when we ship our supplies out. They confiscated all of that material that was in the trash cans, packaged it, and sent it to Washington.
So why were they doing this? What were they looking for?
Well, that's the big question. They never made it clear exactly what they were looking for. They were concerned with, some of the materials we sold in our company. Nothing's illegal or has any problems associated with it, as far as we knew. They confiscated all of the hydrogen system information that we had been working on. They confiscated things that were and photographed things that had nothing to do with the scientific supply business, and they also never told us what they were looking for. So we were kind of at a loss as to what was going on.
George, and now it's sort of culminated, hasn't it? Go ahead, Gene.
George, there is a humorous part to this story, and that is Bob's wife, Joy, met. They started dating and got together after Bob's UFO days. So, and he doesn't really talk about things that happened in his past to a great degree. So Joy, you know, this was her first introduction to the life of Bob Lazar. She has some ninja guys pointing automatic weapons at her nose when she's in bed on a random Saturday morning. Now, this might happen all the time in Bob Lazar's life, but she had never been exposed to this, so it was quite a shock for her.
So there they are. They're investigating the things that you're selling over the internet and through the mails on your company, United Nuclear. They're there, and now, more recently, the investigation has culminated in a very dramatic fashion, has it not?
Oh, yeah. They want to press criminal charges. Now, I think they basically had nothing to really charge us with. So they came down to a criminal charge of shipping materials illegally. But I sincerely, well, I don't know. I really doubt some of the claims they've made as to why they decided to raid the place with such tremendous force. I mean, bringing the SWAT team out and guys in camo and spending $75,000 on an operation where they overflew with airplanes, photographing the house, looking for best points of entry, and as opposed to picking up the telephone and calling or sending somebody over saying, well, we'd like to check this and this, if that's okay with you. And, you know, what they did, I mean, it had nothing to do or...
You don't think it had anything to do with the business?
No, it didn't. And unfortunately, because this is now just going to court, I was kind of hoping I could talk more about it. But my attorney told me not to say anything too in-depth pertaining to this.
Have you actually been charged?
I really, really suspect this has nothing whatsoever to do with the sale of, you know, general scientific supplies.
George, I can talk.
Okay.
Bob can't. And,
has he been charged?
It could be payback time for being Bob Lazar and spilling the secrets. You never know.
Possible, you know, or it could have something to do with the hydrogen fuel systems. I'm really surprised at their actions and what they're telling us the problem is. It just doesn't match up. I mean, it's ridiculous. Even the search warrant that was presented. Now, you know, for somebody to get a search warrant, they have to present an affidavit to a judge. And all search warrants have the affidavit attached to them. Well, we should be able to access, anybody should, a search warrant, given the search warrant number and going to a courthouse and finding out what the problem is. See the affidavit that's attached to it. Well, when we try and do that, they tell us our search warrant is sealed and the affidavit isn't accessible. So this is just typical of what's been going on virtually my entire life.
Well, at least ever since you went on the air on KLAS and spilled the beans about S4. We're gonna take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Gene Huff and Bob Lazar, get into some specifics about exactly what materials you sold over through your business that they were most interested in. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp, sitting in for Art Bell. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm your guest host, George Knapp, broadcasting live here in Las Vegas, sitting in for Art Bell. My guests this evening, Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. We'll be talking a little bit later about Area 51, S4, flying saucers, things of that sort. But first, we're looking at the latest development in the long and complicated Lazar saga. Bob has just been telling us about government raids at his property in New Mexico, where he runs a home-based business. Bob, am I to understand that you have actually been charged? And if so, what are the charges?
Well, they're attempting to bring charges against us. As of this moment, I don't know what the exact status is. But what the criminal charges are, I don't know myself.
Do you know what the chemicals are that they seem to have focused on, or the products that they are focusing on that you sold? I understood that maybe there had been some sort of a sting operation involved in this.
No, I don't believe there's anything along the lines of a sting operation. The chemicals are just general laboratory chemicals, you know, oxidizers and anything else you'd find in a laboratory. In addition, we sell model rocketry supplies and glassware and, you know, just about anything you'd run into. Nothing that's extraordinarily dangerous.
So you're not selling bomb-making material?
No. I mean, we do have chemicals and things like that where you can make fireworks, but we're not talking about high explosives or terrorist material or poisons or anything like that. That's not the case.
You know, the rumors have been, and you hear them as well, Gene, that Bob Lazar is sold out to the government. He was a disinformation agent all these years, spreading these lies about S4 and flying saucers, and now he's living off his fat government contracts because he's sold out. This development sort of suggests you're not in such good standing with your pals in the government, right?
I don't quite remember retiring off a big government salary. No, I wouldn't say they're pals at all.
You know, this is not the first time that these kinds of things happen, and I know because I lived through a lot of it. Gene, I wonder if you could help me fill in the gaps. You know, a lot of people have a lot of problems with Bob's story. We all know why. I've been reading these emails from physicists and others who say, there's no 115. It doesn't exist. Bob's physics and propulsion system don't make sense. But I think a lot of these folks, even if that is true, and we'll grant that for the moment, a lot of folks who are critics of the Lazar story don't know the things that really went down in his life, in your life, back in the day. Things much very similar to what's happening to him now. Gene, you lived through it. Can you tell us a little bit about the kinds of things that happened? You know, whether people believe Bob was ever out there or not, or saw flying saucers, the kinds of things that happened after he went on the air.
After he went on the air.
After he went on the air way back in 1989. People, you know, the phones and people following him and things of that nature.
Right. I was, back then I was working with National Appraisal Service on Eastern Avenue here in Las Vegas, and you know, people were following Bob all the time. Government agents were following him, and it would be funny. I'd have a gun there at my office, and Bob would come screeching up in a car, run into my office, say, "Give me a gun." I'd hand him a gun. He'd run outside, get back in his car, and go screaming down the street. And I wouldn't see him for a couple of days. And these were just, you know, strange ongoing circumstances, constant clicks and other voices on his phone, and just things you see in the movies. You know, when you're living through them, I mean, all of us hear strange clicks on our phones. And then, you know, when he got debriefed out at, I think he was at Indian Springs Air Force Base, right before he got kicked out of the program, they actually had transcripts of everything he had said on his phone and his wife had said on the telephone, and he then knew that the clicks weren't just clicks, that they actually had been listening, and we weren't imagining things. George, you know, what was your previous guest name, Eric Davis?
Right.
Did he say when he, Bob, did you listen to the show before we came on here?
No, as you can tell, I just woke up, which is why I don't know what guy.
There was a physicist on here named Eric Davis that said he asked your female supervisor, not that you ever had a female supervisor, at least that I was aware of, or you told me about, if you had worked out there and she pulled up your record on a computer and you worked as some physics technician out at Area 51, but you weren't able to go into the areas that required security clearance. You know, George, as you well know,
Wait. What is this now?
George, you and the rest of some of the greatest researchers in the United States and other countries and everyone in the world tried to access Bob Lazar's background, and now you've got a guy who says he just asked Bob's supervisor and she pulled his record up on the computer. You know, so
That's true. Actually, we were going to get into this a little bit later, but maybe this is the time to it. And I have a stack of emails here written by a variety of folks. There's a former Air Force officer, Captain Robert Collins, who's written extensively in this area, who cites a number of sources who confirm that Bob was in fact out at Area 51, but that he only visited the place 22 times, worked in a very low level technical position, and never had access to the saucers. They believe that you were at the base, Bob. They believe that the saucers were out there. They just don't believe that you ever worked on them.
They also said he was a stealth fighter mechanic.
Stealth fighter mechanic, there's something interesting.
Yeah, I think the statement, the sources have told these folks, and it's been widely reported on the Internet, that, Bob, that you were stationed at Tonopah for a time being, that you worked on the avionics of the stealth program. I'm giving you a chance now to respond to it directly.
Oh, come on. That's ridiculous. That's absolutely ridiculous.
George, two things from comments on when Eric Davis and the subsequent callers about the time machine. First of all, if the guy with the time machine that could see forward and backward in time could get us some info before we put our bets down on Monday night's final basketball game for the NCAA, that would be helpful. And secondly, you know, I think Bob not elaborating in the Lazard tape and other interviews on element 115 has caused some problems when a lab synthesizes some 115. And if Bob would explain how they do that, I mean, these particles, these atoms go flying through these sensors, and they'll exist for a fraction of a second. No one has a quantity of it that they can hold in their hand. But the 115 that Bob dealt with was kept under neutron bombardment at rest. And Bob, I mean, it could have been an isotope or what. I don't know. I'm not a physicist of 115, but there were a lot of extenuating circumstances about this 115. It wasn't just a clump of 115. They had to take great care to make it exist, right?
Yeah, I mean, no, I don't know how we got to talking about UFOs so quickly. We were just discussing the raid and everything here, and I can't believe you guys snuck that in.
I was trying to help out the listeners. They don't want to.
We're gonna get back on track here in a minute.
When they synthesize elements, and there's a variety of ways, and you know, a popular new way is nuclei fusion, where you just accelerate particles or subatomic particles at each other, and cyclotrons or linear accelerators, and you basically smash these things together, or by other means transmute elements, and you can make or attempt to make elements not yet discovered that will appear on the periodic chart. One of them is element 115, and when they did synthesize a couple atoms of this recently, people think when they do these procedures, they wind up with a measurable amount, like a gram or so of the material. All they succeed in doing is really creating a few atoms of it that fly through detectors, and through various techniques and timing, they can tell what those particles are, and that's about it. They can never measure or analyze these elements in depth when they make it that way. And those higher level elements, simply because you only get such small amounts.
Well, we're going to go into 115 in depth a little bit later, but before we leave this, now this raid that's happened on your home, I mean, Gene was filling in some of the gaps about other things that happened to you way back when. I remember being over to your house, and you were looking out the window and holding an Uzi because you're worried about somebody coming in. There were break-ins, weren't there? Not only to your house, but your car?
Yeah, there really were. And like I said, it was really a traumatic time, and I had mentioned this back then when I did my original interviews, that a lot of people look upon this as something that would be really cool to happen, or aren't you excited to have been part of this? And this is nothing that I profited over. This is nothing that I ever would do again, really. And, yeah, in some aspects, and I've mentioned this before, that I do feel privileged to have been part of the program, but, it certainly wasn't worth it. And for people making claims like I'm now friends with the government and they support me and I'm just some rich guy living out in the forest in New Mexico, now those claims are ridiculous. I never do interviews or lectures. I mean, I try and divorce myself from this stuff completely, and a lot of people don't understand that. But, you know, it's almost like if you were a victim of a crime, of a rape or something like that, it's not something that you go and talk about the rest of your life. You know, this is something that I am not interested in. I was only interested in the technology of the program, which is why I was attracted to the job. And, I'm not a UFO enthusiast. I don't do lectures, and it was only the technology that got me into this. And, that's about it. This is nothing that's part of my life. It's nothing that's paying me any money. And it's something that I really hate even talking about.
We're going to take a short break and then force you to talk about it some more, even though you hate it. We're talking with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. I'm George Knapp, filling in for Art Bell. We're taking a short break. My guests tonight are sort of outlaws from the world of ufology. Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. You're still there, right, guys?
We're here.
Yeah, I have to apologize for being so sleepy. I mean, I've got coffee brewing now, but I took a sleeping pill to get an early nap, and I'm one of those guys, if I take an aspirin, it hits me like a sledgehammer. So,
oh, it sounds
bear
great.
With me. I will wake up and be lucid in a short time.
George, right. I'd like to make a comment. I mean, no, all kidding aside, on Bob's personal life, he went through rough times after he got kicked out of the program at S4. Personally, financially, he had a couple of bad relationships. He was destroyed financially. A lot of external circumstances. The economy changed. Things changed. I think it's curious that now he and his wife have a nice little business going, and for the first time in probably a decade, he's back on his feet financially, and now is when the federal government chooses to raid and prosecute him on bogus charges. It's almost like while he was down, they kept hands off, but they, you know, maybe I'm being paranoid, but I don't know why they waited to the first time he's achieved a little success once again financially, and they choose now to prosecute him.
Well, I was not trying to beat a dead horse in talking about some of the things that happened in his life long ago, break-ins in the house and his car and death threats and the phones tapped and people following him, only to emphasize that even though a lot of people don't buy the story and they have their own reasons for not buying it, something really was going on back then and something is still going on now. There is another possibility that maybe it's not related to any of the revelations you made back in 1989. You mentioned that you're also working on a hydrogen system for automobiles. Tell me about the system. Tell me how far along it is. And maybe, Gene, you can speculate on whether that would be a reason for them to come after them.
Okay.
Well, anything's really possible. The hydrogen system I actually started working on as far back as the 70s, something that I tinkered around with during the gas crisis, and just was something I played around with on and off. And there really is no big trick to running a car on hydrogen. I mean, you can basically run your own car on hydrogen with just a few minor changes. The trick with hydrogen is storing it, and you can either store it as a gas in a big giant metal cylinder in your car somewhere under a lot of pressure so you can hold as much as you can and burn it that way. You can super cool liquid hydrogen, or hydrogen, so it's liquid hydrogen, and therefore you have an increased density, and the tank that holds it needs to be smaller. The problem is with both of these things, among other problems, is it's pretty explosive in that fashion. If you get in a car accident, you have a big tank of compressed hydrogen, it releases, ignites, possibly explodes. Liquid hydrogen is even worse because on top of it, it's absolutely freezing cold. This stuff is hundreds of degrees below zero, and in addition to immediately evaporating and possibly igniting and causing burns and all that kind of stuff. There is a third way to store hydrogen, and that's in a metal hydride. And some materials have the ability to absorb hydrogen like a sponge absorbs water. And once it's absorbed and stored in that material, it's essentially non-flammable. Yeah, it will smolder somewhat, but it does not present the hazard of these either of these other methods of storage. And that's something that I was interested in and we started working on.
And I've been to your house there in New Mexico. I've seen this 30-foot long particle accelerator that I guess has a role in the system that you developed. I know that you have this hydrogen system in your own two vehicles and that it's been a heck of a long time since you've had to buy gasoline. Is that right?
Yeah, the first car we converted was a Chevrolet Corvette and then a Mitsubishi Endeavor. And now we're looking at converting a GMC. But our vehicles have been running on for hydrogen for quite a while, and we manufacture the fuel ourselves. And it's something that we'd really like to do as many vehicles as possible. And the business we're talking about is United Nuclear, and what we want to do is manufacture kits so you can easily convert your existing car.
So how close are you to a system that could be mass-produced and available for consumers? Because I think it's relevant to where we're heading with this conversation.
Right. Well, like I said, the system, I mean, there are a couple little quirks here and there, but nothing serious. I mean, you can certainly put a conversion kit on your car. Like I said, our cars have been running for years on hydrogen. The problem is the material, the hydride itself. And although there are other hydrides available, the particular hydride blend we came up with can be charged and discharged a lot more often and also holds a lot more hydrogen than the commonly available hydrides. The particle accelerator I built is used in the manufacture of that. The problem is that one of the materials in our hydride is classified as a weapon material.
Well, that might be some reason somebody might be interested in you then.
Well, yeah, it might be. It's a thermonuclear weapon material. It's nothing that, you know, a terrorist can get a hold of. It in itself is not, you know, it cannot be used as an explosive or anything along those lines. So, yeah, is that a possibility that they cause such a fuss about it? I guess it's possible, but...
Well, I'm thinking more...
Why didn't they say so?
Well, I'm thinking more along another line, and that is this: if your cars are already running on this hydrogen system and the potential exists for mass production and mass consumption of this, that there might be other people who might be interested in causing you trouble. I think, Gene, you have an idea about where I'm heading with that one.
George, you know, you hear all these paranoid stories about, well, yeah, we could get cheap, easy, even free fuel, but the agencies in the federal government are preventing it because then they won't be able to sell oil. But, Bob, I think you should add to this story when about the little visit from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and how you had to have one of them on site, and they even wanted to charge you. How much was it to fire up your own particle accelerator to replenish this hydrogen? The federal government intervened right there in his own, on his own property in his own particle accelerator, right?
Well, yeah. Technically, I'm not allowed to operate my particle accelerator. And technically, believe it or not, it's not the NRC. Do you know who regulates lasers and particle accelerators?
I don't.
The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, believe it or not. This is how our government is set up. Anyway, I'm not allowed to operate my own accelerator that I built, and nor can you. You're not allowed to build any machine that can produce radiation. You must have a license to manufacture, operate, or virtually conceive a radiation-producing machine. So I can't even run the thing legally. And it doesn't replenish the hydrogen. It's just used in the manufacture of the storage material. So,
but don't you have to pay for them to come?
Oh, well, then there's, yeah, then there's the possibility of a license that's $5,000 a month. I mean, this the regulations they impose on this are absolutely ridiculous.
And you would say imposed to prevent people from inventing their own hydrogen systems or...
No, I mean, these were in place, but and who knows what reason they created these laws for. I imagine to protect the public, so I guess for some reason if you want to build an X-ray machine, you're not allowed to, and then you can't hurt yourself beaming yourself with X-rays. It's the only radiation-producing machine I think would be easy for somebody to make. But in any case, it was obvious what this machine is being used for. It's not being used in the production of weapon materials or anything like that. And this is not the only faction of the government that's given us a hassle. We had just about everybody from every department here on one particular day. Everything from the building and inspection to the fire department. I mean, it's as if somebody suddenly put us in the crosshairs and said, just fire.
You know? I'm gonna take a short break again. When I come back, I'll ask you to list all the different departments that were out there raiding your house. Those building guys, they're pretty tough. And we'll be right back with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. I'm George Knapp, filling in for Art Bell on Coast to Coast. We are joined this evening by Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. And we're talking about some very recent developments in Bob's life that sort of fit the longer pattern. Bob, back to your hydrogen fuel system for cars. You were mentioning that your home in New Mexico was raided by a whole laundry list of agencies. ATF, were they there?
If they were, they didn't identify themselves. Now, virtually nobody identified themselves except the local people. And by the local people, I mean the people from the fire department or the building and zoning and the local sheriff and
FBI.
Yeah, I believe the FBI was there. There was another government agency, and they never identified themselves, so I don't know who they were. But, you know, the SWAT team, they didn't need to identify themselves. That was pretty obvious.
You said black ninja outfits? I mean, seriously?
No. what they did wear that was really interesting, and it was the first time I ever saw it, was camo. And this isn't the camo you wear just as a normal soldier would. This is kind of that drop cloth with real twigs and branches sticking out of it. It's hilarious, but it wasn't hilarious that day. These guys came up from the bottom of the property, and then another force came in from the top, apparently in case we tried to get away from whatever it is was going on. And, yeah, then they had just your range of typical SWAT guys that called us out on the megaphone, and, you know, we came to the door and they handcuffed us. But obviously this was a big old operation. Interesting thing that happened is one of the agents left his legal pad, which was wonderful and had a wealth of information on it. And that's where we learned where they had previously photographed our property from the air, looking for possible ways to escape and any other buildings and things like that we had around. So it was
when I mentioned earlier that I was just kidding about a sting operation, but do you believe that they have that agents posing as customers have purchased things from you as a way to sort of build a case against you?
Well, I know that's happened to a fact, or without a doubt. And look, there are prosaic explanations for all of this stuff. You know, it's possible that, look, being a scientific supply outlet, you know, maybe they thought we were a drug manufacturer or something like that. They're, you know, doing some other illegal activity because of all the weird equipment, chemicals, radioactive materials we order and resell. You know, maybe these guys just thought, you know, boy, something else has got to be going on there, and they just thought this was a gamble that might pay off, and it just didn't. It might have nothing to do with, you know, my past or the hydrogen system, but it's just incredibly suspicious to me.
George, well, I mean, yeah, go ahead, Gene.
If I interject here, as usual, Bob's being a little modest. I mean, this hydrogen fuel system isn't something he tinkered with a little bit since the late 70s. I mean, it's fully functional. He drives his cars on it, and if Bob... if it was legal to provide this, I mean, Bob could, you know, put literally a hydrogen fuel system on just about any car, and they could get the hydrogen via electrolysis with the solar panel on their garage roof. But Bob, these hydrides that you store the hydrogen in that you say could be used to make a thermonuclear device, I thought you told me those were kept in a complete vacuum, and if just some normal guy like George or I opened it, they would be destroyed once the vacuum was broken. You'd have to be a highly trained, a physicist, something along that line, to actually make a bomb out of those hydrides, wouldn't you? I mean, the guy walking down the street couldn't do that.
I mean, all the hydrides do is store hydrogen. I mean, in a weapon, that's the material that stores the hydrogen, like the hydrogen in a hydrogen bomb.
Right.
And to get it to go off, you need an atomic bomb already. So unless you already have an atomic bomb, this material is useless to you as a weapon.
Here's the theory that I was pursuing to see what you guys think about it. But I mean, if this hydrogen system works and revolutionizes the transportation industry, it would obviously have bad effects on the oil industry. Given our political environment and the amount of influence that this oil industry has, couldn't you be viewed as a potential threat to very large industries? I mean, we've all heard the stories. Certainly the listeners of Art Bell have heard the stories about promising energy technologies that are quashed because they represent a threat to the profits of major international corporations. Has that crossed your mind?
Yeah, I mean, you always hear people talk about stuff like that, and I generally don't believe it. I don't think that can be the case. And, you know, using hydrogen is not new at all. You know, we've been able to store more in a smaller space than previously. And it's, if the system is fairly easy to install on a car. In fact, what we want to do is sell kits so you can install it yourself or have a mechanic to install it. And you can't tell me that major auto manufacturers and other people haven't stumbled on this. I mean, unless we just happen to hit on the perfect combination and we really can store more hydrogen than ever before, and, you know, then it is something pretty significant. But the bottom line is the system does work. Is it possible we're stepping on somebody's toes? Yeah, I guess it's possible. I'm not sure if that's the case. But, you know, we do have something we'd like to market, but instead of getting help through the government, I mean, in every way, shape, and form, everybody has stood in our way. Now, I don't know if I'm just paranoid, but it's just suspicious that all this stuff has suddenly happened right at the same time. You know, we basically announced that we have this and we want to bring it to market.
Gene, I know your politics a bit. Would you like to elaborate on that
just
possibility?
Because the president is the son of a rich and famous oil family, George, I think we're being paranoid. After all, I mean, no one would use the federal government, manipulate the federal government just for the sake of oil, do you think?
Well, I mean, do you think that that's what's happening?
I don't know. I mean, it would have to be a pretty comprehensive program. I would hate to think that with all of the all of the situations prevailing in the world, the war in Iraq, the fact that, you know, everyone hates them, you know, the plethora of global warming, you name it, the problems we got, that they're worrying about Bob Lazar, you know, replenishing some hydrides with the hydrogen down at his ranch down in New Mexico, would be, you know, high on the minds of the federal government. You know, I it's difficult to be that paranoid, but I think it's true. I mean, we know that cars could be run on, well, some cars are running on hydrogen, but everyone could be driving in a car today that did not run on gasoline if it weren't for the fact that the oil companies, you know, and it has to be with the help of the car manufacturers, are trying to use the oil as long as they've got it. Let's face it, if you look at history in big chunks of time, you know, not in billions of years like the universe or the earth, but 5,000 years, I mean, oil was really only valuable for the past 100 years and the next 100 years. I mean, the Arabs weren't rich people historically. It's just 100 years ago when we found we needed all of this oil, they happened to be over an ocean of it. So I think they want to, you know, pump it out and sell it while they can. 100 years from now, 200 years from now, no one will be driving gas-powered cars unless they're classic cars. And so, yeah, I do feel there is an agreement, certainly between the Saudi royal family, the Bush royal family, everyone in the United States, to get while the getting's good, sell the oil while people are complacent enough and comfortable enough, or at least trusting enough to think that we won't destroy the earth by burning fossil fuels, and so they can sell it while they make their money while they can.
Bringing it back to your business, Bob, United Nuclear, who are your customers? I mean, are you selling to terrorists? You know, I've been on your website. You've got this one animated figure of a guy, and the caption under it is, "Got uranium." You're selling uranium pellets that you found on public lands. And, I mean, it's post-2001. Don't you think that you're going to attract government attention? I'll tell you what, I think we're going to have to take a break here. So you'll have to answer that question when we come back. Okay. We're talking with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. I'm George Knapp in for Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening, everyone. Welcome back to Coast. As mentioned, I'm George Knapp, live in Las Vegas, most exciting city in the world, in my opinion. And we're talking with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. One brief note, Art Bell, by the way, who I'm filling in for tonight. Art Bell will be back on April 15th, and I'm sure all his loyal listeners can't wait for that. Back to Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. Bob, before the break, I had a question for you. You know, on your website for United Nuclear, you've got this little animated guy whose eyebrows move up and down, and the caption underneath of it is, "Got uranium." And I know from speaking to you before that one of the products you first started selling online was uranium pellets that you'd go out and gather in the desert on public land. And I wonder, you know, what are you thinking? I mean, wouldn't you think that in post 9/11 world that you're going to attract some attention selling that?
Well, hang on. Let me make a correction first. What we sell is uranium ore. Not uranium pellets. By seeing uranium pellets, you made the hair stand up on the back of all the people from the NRC thinking these are reactor fuel pellets. They're not. What we sell is uranium ore, among, you know, a wide variety of other scientific equipment, chemicals, and whatnot. And, no, uranium ore is not a dangerous thing. You can't make a bomb out of it. Well, if you have gigantic quantities of it and the power of an entire city to process it and several years, yes, you can purify uranium. But selling little pieces of ore here and there for science experiments and experiments involving radiation or physics is, you know, is completely harmless.
Who are your customers, though? I mean, I'm assuming you're not selling to Osama bin Laden, and that's not the reason that the government is looking at you. Who are your customers?
Actually, an increasing amount of our customers are federal agencies now, which is really strange. I was under the impression they wouldn't do any business with me. But I have been proven wrong that in two accounts. First of all, we wound up getting a government contract. And second of all, just an increasing number of government agencies from the military, specifically the Navy and the Army, and other government factions, like the Border Patrol, for instance, buys infrared flashlights from us. The Department of Naval Sea Warfare buys ultraviolet equipment and, you know, things of that sort. Fire departments throughout the United States, that's actually the, I guess, the most common customer of radioactive ore. And what the fire departments use it for is everybody's training for homeland security exercises. So they'll typically buy a piece of ore and maybe a piece of ore and a Geiger counter from us, and they'll hide it somewhere, and this way they can train the people that operate the equipment to try and find the radioactive ore with the Geiger counter, and they just use it in other drills and, you know, things of that sort. So we sell to a wide variety of schools and universities, too, and, of course, the general public.
NASA?
Wasn't NASA one of your customers?
Yeah, they were. I don't remember.
George, this isn't all for necessarily for uranium ore. They have a wide range of products we sell.
For listeners just joining us, we've been talking about the latest chapter in the Bob Lazar saga, a raid on his property in New Mexico by a host of agencies who seized records and equipment and things of that sort as part of a possible criminal investigation into his business, United Nuclear. Bob, we're going to, just to wrap up this part of the conversation, can you tell us where you think this case is headed? Is there a date? Is there a point on the calendar at which you're going to know something?
Well, no, there's no specific date yet. It's basically finding out, and we've hired attorneys to discuss this with them, exactly what do you want? What is the problem? What are you going to charge us with? What, you know, exactly, specifically, write down what the problem is. This could have all been taken care of if it's just something that we're selling or just a customer that we're dealing with or something. This could have been handled by a telephone call, but nothing in my wildest imagination would be reason to take the path that they've chosen. So, I don't know. It's kind of a wait and see.
Any word from your lawyer on his take on this thing or whether he thinks you'll be indicted?
No, nothing specific. I mean, anything's possible. It depends how hard they want to push on this and exactly what's the problem. Is it, in fact, that it's just some chemicals? Is it, in, you know, the real problem customers we're dealing with? You know, it's something we need to find out.
Just another day in the life, I guess.
Yeah, it's not a fun day in the life.
Well, listen, I hate to take another break right now, but we're about to jump into the inevitable topic, UFOs, S4, all that stuff. You knew it was coming. But I think before we start that, we're going to get this break out of the way, and we'll be right back with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. I'm George Knapp, and for Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening, everyone. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp in Las Vegas, filling in for Art Bell. Our guests, Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. And this is probably the part of the conversation that the audience wants to hear the most, but that Bob probably regrets speaking about the most. And I mean, all the stories that that emanated from you starting back in 1989 about Area S4 and Area 51 and flying saucers and things of that sort. Gene, I wonder if I can impose upon you to sort of make a synopsis, a thumbnail sketch of this story as it unfolded for the benefit of those listeners who may not be familiar with it.
That is an imposition, isn't it? Well, let's see. Bob Bob would probably better just tell the story better than me, but I'll just say it so he can answer UFO questions. He moved to Las Vegas in the early 1980s and had some small businesses going and decided to get back into the scientific community. So he sent resumes out to a few places, and one of the guys he sent a resume out to was Dr. Edward Teller. Edward Teller is the father of the hydrogen bomb. Bob had met him when he worked at Los Alamos in the early 80s. Bob had built a little Honda with a jet engine in it, and the local newspaper in Los Alamos did a front-page story on him. Edward Teller coincidentally came to speak at Los Alamos on that very day, and when Bob was going over to the auditorium to listen to Teller's speech, lo and behold, Teller was sitting on a wall reading the new front page story about Bob's jet car, and Bob used that as an avenue to introduce himself to Edward Teller. And anyway, so back to the 80s now, Bob sends out resumes and gets a response from Edward Teller, gets an interview out at EG&G when it was located out on Sunset Road near McCarran Airport here in Las Vegas. Bob, how did it go from there? I forget how it went from
He gets hired into a program.
Yeah, he gets
right?
hired in. They just said it was in propulsion systems. I don't know what he thought it would be, if he thought it would be jet propulsion or whatever in an outer area. And so then they flew him out to Area 51, and he went through, well, first he went through security checks. The Office of Personnel Management, who does the background checks on all these people, came to his friends and neighbors and, you know, mom and dad and everyone to check him out, as would happen with anyone getting a security clearance. And he was flown out to Area 51, and I think Bob should take it from there, because that's the great story of when he was taken down to S4 in the briefing room, reading the reports for the first time. Bob, why don't you take it?
S4 is a facility south of Groom Lake. It has its own dry lake bed down there. And you, Bob, you say, as I recall, the story was that there was a facility built into the mountainside, designed to sort of make it look like it was part of the mountain, but inside was a fairly amazing facility.
Yeah, it was a research facility that had hangar doors along the side of the mountain, and after going through all kinds of security checks and, like you said, of my background and whatnot, eventually they drove me down to S4, and initially they just had me reading briefings that contained just an amazing amount of information, but some pretty bizarre information.
Aliens, flying saucers.
Yeah, you got it. And I really didn't know what to make of it, and they were trying to get me caught up to speed as quickly as possible involving this project. And unbeknownst to me, the project was to back engineer the propulsion and power system of an alien spacecraft. And they eventually did show me the craft a short time. Oh, I think I'd only been there two or three times. And instead of coming through the main entrance of the place, they brought me in through the hangar, and I saw one of the craft, and
eventually you saw nine of them.
Right. Nine of them when all the hangar doors were open, the internal bay doors. And it was my job to do, at least be part of the team. Each aspect of the craft had its own group of people working on it, and they really compartmentalize everything that way, so nobody has the entire breadth of knowledge about the entire project. And like I said, basically I just was involved in the propulsion and power system of the craft. I worked with one other fellow, and I was only there for a short time. I didn't work there for years or anything along those lines. But let's see. Boy, a life story is so hard for me to do. One thing leads to another. I wind up telling Gene and a few other friends because I work at odd hours of the morning and evening. And I wind up telling John Lear, Gene Huff, finally told my wife and another friend, Jim Taliani, what was going on.
And you went out into the desert and showed them.
Yeah, since I had the test flight times of the craft, I knew what time and where to go in the desert to look. So we finally did sneak out there one night and got to show these guys what I was working on and, went home. And as time went on, we managed to get caught doing that.
By the way, that's using sneak in the absolute loosest sense of the term. We went out there in an RV and sat out in the desert. This was 1989. Since then, George, after you did UFOs, the best evidence in 1990, of course, the little alien out at Rachel out there has become an international tourist stop. And there, there were tour buses going out there, but back then there was literally no one in the desert in the middle of the week. They tested on Wednesdays and we went out there and, you could have heard a pin drop in the desert. I mean, it was a starry sky. Nothing else going except, of course, until that little light popped up over the mountain and started jumping around in the sky. And so now people go out there and look and see all kinds of things. And, they find the story hard to believe, but the difference between the desert outside Area 51 in late 88 and early 89 and in the early 1990s after you produced UFOs, the best evidence, was night and day.
Back in those days, people forget that, there are all kinds of people who have bad things to say about you, Bob. And I can tell, how much you like talking about this story.
Well, it's really, I just cannot believe the amount of people that come up with the strangest stories that involve me. It just amazes me. Some of these stories are just so ridiculous. And I don't know why people pretend or feel obligated to tell their friends or other people that they know me when they don't. I mean, I think I've told you the story before. I was driving through Flagstaff from Las Vegas on the way to New Mexico, and I was listening to an AM talk show to keep me awake because it was late at night, and I hear something that sounded similar to the Art Bell show, but it wasn't. It was some conversation going on about UFOs, and I was just kind of popping around on the channel, and I heard my name mentioned, and here's a guy that's giving an interview to the radio host, telling him how he just had lunch or dinner with me, something like that, and how I confided him all these new facts and things like that. But, this kind of stuff goes on all the time about the most ridiculous stories, and look, you get most of the emails. Fortunately, I don't, and like this guy that just said I worked on the stealth fighter. Where do people pull this stuff out of? It's unreal.
George, my favorite part of this story is that people either say Bob Lazar never did anything, they didn't even graduate from high school, till, he did things far beyond what he said he did, and they saw him out there and they can vouch for it because they went all the places that not even Bob Lazar was allowed to go. And, that's the funniest thing. Like the gentleman you had on before we came on here tonight says that, Bob, he said that you had a female supervisor, and I'd like to know when. Eric Davis, was that his name, George?
Dr. Eric Davis, yes.
Yeah, and he said, I don't know when he did this, but he says he asked Bob's supervisor if Bob worked there. Well, how would he know if
where?
Was Bob,
what supervisor?
Out at Area 51. He says you had a female supervisor. Well, how did he know she was Bob's supervisor before she checked to see if Bob worked there? If she's got to check on a computer to see when and where he worked, then how did Eric Davis know that she was a supervisor? Not to mention that Bob never, ever had a female supervisor at all, right?
Wait, was this a female supervisor when I was supposedly working on the F-117?
I don't know, but this was the...
No, I think it's at the brothel.
Oh, okay.
I'm just joking with you. That's not the only version of this story. It's, you know, a lot of people, exactly what you're saying, Gene, a lot of people don't buy it at all. Bob was never out there. He doesn't have his degrees. He's not a scientist. His physics doesn't make sense. We don't believe him. And then on the other hand, you got people, yeah, he was out there, but he worked on this or he worked on that, and we've confirmed it. It's hard to reconcile the two stories, no?
Well, Bob always, you know, he prefaces when he starts to describe the heavy element, the propulsion system, everything. He goes, now look, current physics on Earth, we have no idea what gravity is. We don't have these heavy elements. We don't have this and this and this. And he prefaces it with this, gives an explanation, and then all of the other people go, wait a minute. We don't know what gravity is. We don't have these heavy elements on Earth. They repeat the exact same thing he said and act like they're being critical and bringing up something that the rest of us don't know.
Well, let me run this one by you, Bob, because I just got a copy of this today. A guy named Tim Ventura. Do you recognize that name?
Oh, yeah. That's a guy I spoke to three or four times. He, I don't know if it's him or if he's actually made a company, and he makes these little electrostatic propelled craft out of balsa wood and aluminum foil, these little models that demonstrate ion or electrostatic propulsion and lift off the table.
Well, he's written this report, and I'm sorry to spring this on you, about he says in 2003 he spoke a lot of times to you. He was building a relationship with you so he could eventually conduct an interview about Area 51, and that you talked about a lot of different things. He says, to his credit, he says, you know, if I had a UFO, I wanted to understand after my team of physicists gave up in despair because they couldn't fit the technology to existing physicists, I'd bring in people like Lazar who would ask interesting questions and get unique answers. He says that in 2003, you told him several times that your number one customer for Geiger counter equipment were Los Alamos and Sandia National Labs, that you had visited both of those labs. Your wife, girlfriend corroborated the story. And then the interesting part, in October 2003, you called him up and said you'd been doing contract work. This guy had been doing contract work at Telecommunication Systems in Seattle, and that a certain scientific team that you, Bob, were involved in had been scouring the web for material on lifters, stealing data from this guy. He seems to imply that you got really mysterious on him on behalf of government agencies, and that maybe you were working as an agent. Does this ring a bell?
All right.
So you're admitting it.
No. Okay. This is another typical example of it. Just an ordinary story that gets completely tweaked into another realm of existence. I contacted.
So,
well, go ahead.
I'll tell you what, I think we're not going to have time to finish the story, so when we come back from this break, we can talk about that. We'll also address the question of whether you're a disinformation agent, because that's a question a lot of people have. And we may even get to talk about a wild, wacky UFO guy named Dan Burrish. Stay tuned. I'm George Knapp, in for Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM. Right before the break, Bob, I was mentioning a guy named Tim Ventura, who wrote a very detailed report that appeared on the Internet today about his previous encounters with you. At the top of this report, it says, in late 2003, Bob Lazar recruited me to work on a top-secret propulsion project at Sandia National Labs that probably never existed. Lazar speaks believably, and if it wasn't for the story itself, I never would have questioned his veracity. 2 years later, I still don't have the answers, but I do have a lot of questions. What he says was, along the lines, after talking to you many times on the phone, that he was told that you were in Washington, D.C. You got back on the phone with him after returning from D.C. and said you'd been meeting with high-ranking officers about putting together a secret project to develop this prototype aircraft using technologies that had been found online in the open-source community. So he wonders, was there a secret project at Sandia to develop such a craft, and what was your involvement with it? What's your version of this story?
Well, like I said, this is one of those typical stories that gets distorted into another realm of consciousness here. Basically, I've never met this guy, Tim Ventura. I spoke to him on the phone a few times, and basically, apparently, how this got started was me calling him. I knew of someone and met them. Now, who they were affiliated with was never all that clear. He did work for Sandia, and whether his project was government-funded or privately funded was never really clear. anyway, what this guy was producing was an electrostatic lifting vehicle. And it was just a larger model. A Tim Ventura guy makes these little, I guess you would use them for science fair projects or something, little tabletop balsa wood and aluminum foil things. You apply high voltage to them, and they lift up. It's a demonstration of electrostatic propulsion, which is nothing new. This guy had a large-scale version of it and apparently was planning on making something much bigger, and anyway wanted to recruit me for consulting in the project. There's nothing secret or anything along those lines. However, he always made a big deal about keeping things quiet, about, you know, who I mentioned anything to. But as far as I know, there's nothing secret about this. A short time later, I had remembered seeing something just like that on the internet and kind of browsed around a while and found Tim Ventura's page and said, you know, boy, that thing looks exactly like what this guy is doing. Now, I called Tim Ventura, who I don't think I had spoken to ever before, and just mentioned to him that there were these other guys using his design and something along those lines, and they were interested in me consulting for him about producing a larger version of this or commercial applications, so on and so forth. And, you know, would you potentially be interested in it, considering that, you know, you've been tinkering with this stuff a hell of a lot longer than me. In fact, I wasn't even that knowledgeable about that particular field.
What about this part of the meeting with high-ranking officers in Washington, D.C.?
Well, I met with this guy and a couple of his buddies, and then mentioned Tim Ventura's name, and, you know, just waited for them to get back to me if this thing was ever going to materialize. You know, a lot of consulting jobs end up this way. Somebody calls, and then you just never hear back from them. But, you know, I mentioned Tim Ventura to them, and a short time later, they got back to me, and I think I got some more information from Tim, and all he said at the time was that he was working in a bank and was really bored with his job, if I recall correctly, and I think possibly doing some computer work or something.
Well, at least it sounds like there is some basis for what Tim is writing.
Oh, yeah, and then, like I said, but it's not a spectacular story or anything, and they got back to me just saying that he was apparently just incredibly underqualified for the job. I mean, apparently he didn't have any, you know, similar work experience. This was just a hobby for him. And that was about it. And I countered with, well, boy, the guy's been tinkering with this stuff for years. He's got a website about it. And what you're making looks exactly like what this guy builds on a daily basis. Don't you guys think you should get together? And we kind of went back and forth. And I asked for more specifics on the project or potential project to give to Tim, who I was just, you know, trying to get an interesting job for. And never really got anything specific, and phone calls weren't returned. And
it kind of fizzled out.
Bob, it just kind of faded away, and that was that.
This type of propulsion system is also what a lot of people who know nothing about propulsion and especially know nothing about the cosmos think could be used to propel flying saucers, right?
Yeah, but
you know what I mean.
It's not. It's not anti-gravity or anything like that. It's just electrostatic propulsion. It's the same thing that keeps the little styrofoam peanut stuck to your hand. It's you can apply a high voltage to.
Isn't that how you used to fly those plates over your Tesla coil and the Van de Graaff generator?
Yeah, and the Van de Graaff. It's just, you know, repulsion of like charges, and also an ion spray off a sharp point with high voltage on it. I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can use electricity to, you know, lift things up. But for deep spacecraft, it is a form of propulsion. In fact, NASA's probes and the upcoming, I think, asteroid probe is going to use a type of ion propulsion. So, but as far as, you know, in the atmosphere flying around, this isn't something useful.
Well, I think the point that he was trying to make is that, you know, here you are traveling with shadowy guys, and you had relationships with Sandia and working on exotic propulsion. You know, we've heard those kinds of of conspiracy theories about you before, that you're a disinformation agent, that you helped the government to spread this whole story.
For what purpose? Why would what's a disinformation agent supposed to be taking your attention away from?
Well, I think people have said taking your attention away from something else that might have been out at 51 or S4, which my response to that has always been, boy, if this was the government's idea to take attention away from something else they had going out there, it was a miserable failure, because the result of your stories coming forward is that Area 51 became a household name. Tens of thousands of people have trekked out there over the years and still do to see whatever is flying around. The state of Nevada dedicated the ET highway that goes right past the base, and I'm sure the folks who run Area 51 are not very happy about this strategy. So if someone came up with it, it didn't work. A lot of folks believe, though, in their hearts that you were working for the government part and parcel, either as an active agent or as a patsy. That's one of the emails I saw yesterday. Somebody compared you to Lee Harvey Oswald. Not that you are dangerous, but that you are a patsy in the big picture. Any comment?
Oh boy, how could I comment on
George,
that? These scenarios just sound ridiculous to me.
George, these scenarios go full circle. Does anyone ever offer any suggestions to you? I always ask them, what in the world could they be hiding that they would go through all this expense and time and trouble to, not to mention, not just the Bob Lazar story, they must be faking UFO sightings all around the world for the past 50 years, for the past millennia, according to, you know, all the historical sightings and everything. All this has been going on so they could hide what? What is it that's going on out there that they're using this as a front for?
Well, no, the question I have is why?
Well,
why would
I
create something like that? Look, I don't like giving interviews. I don't create lectures and get money from this. I don't do anything with it. I'm trying to divorce it as much as possible. It's something that I was involved in one point in my life and spoke about it. And that was that. I have better things to do. This has been an incredible source of aggravation for me. I don't seek public attention. I try and avoid being on the radio and unless somebody just drags me on.
Like me,
You know, other than that, what in the world would you think? I have nothing better to do, and I really am extremely busy, and stuff like this just doesn't make any sense to me. Why in the world would I do that?
Well, there are some things that I know a lot of people don't believe your story, but there are some things that you knew and know that you could not have known otherwise that have been verified. And I'm going to go over that list of things when we come back in just a moment. We're going to take a short break, speaking with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. I'm George Knapp, in for Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening. I'm George Knapp, in for Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM. We're speaking with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff about S4, flying saucers, and things that Mr. Lazar really doesn't want to talk about anymore. But we're sort of forcing him to do it anyway. Bob, when I am questioned by people who don't believe your story whatsoever, who believe you were never out there, that you made all this stuff up, and they point to, look, he can't prove that he went to MIT, he can't prove he went to Caltech, he can't prove he really worked at Los Alamos on any kind of sensitive projects, and he certainly can't prove he was out there at Area 51 or S4. I remember a couple of things that come to mind that suggest that you did, in fact, have these experiences, because they were things that you couldn't have known otherwise. The most obvious one is the fact that disc-shaped objects were flying around out there. You took people out into the desert a couple of times in a row to show them this. I've interviewed those witnesses. I've seen the videotape, something that looks very much like a flying saucer flying around in the exact area and at the exact time that you said it would fly around. So how could you have known when and where? You also knew about the OFI. That's the Office of Federal Investigation. I thought you made a mistake where you're talking about the FBI was the one that was doing a background check on you, but it turns out that you knew the name of the agent, Mike Thigpen, and you knew the existence of OFI, which I had never heard of. Both the Thigpen and the OFI check out. You knew about the designation called S4. To my knowledge, that had never been made public in the past. I was able to confirm that with Nellis Air Force Base, that it's a real place, although they would not confirm where it was. People forget that you passed a polygraph test. We administered this test, a polygraph examiner named Terry Tabernetti, who still works for a major corporate firm here in Las Vegas, a former police officer, put you to the test and said you passed it with flying colors. I know you also had information about the base itself, the little tiny things like where the cafeteria was and how to get around in there. And then, of course, people forget about the difficulty that I had in getting your records. I mean, the song and dance I went through with Los Alamos to get very simple employment records with Los Alamos, plus with the company that had first recruited you to that job. The difficulty that Congressman Bill Bray's office had in getting very simple files from the FBI and others, it suggested to me that something really was going on. I mean, when this comes up, do you give that kind of litany of responses, you or Gene?
No, I don't, and believe it or not, I actually prefer that people don't believe it. And please, I will not be the one that tries to convince you, because if you think the story is ridiculous and don't believe it, please continue to believe that. In fact, tell other people that, because this way I get bothered less. But, this in fact did happen. But like I said, I hate the topic. I don't want to be involved with it anymore. And, you know, all these events did occur in my life, and I did do the things I said I did. And, you know, that's that. And, of course, if the shoe was on the other foot, I've said this before, I don't know if I would believe the story, because I can't present enough evidence. And, you know, being scientifically minded, that's what I go on. Yeah, there is some evidence here and there, but I can't physically bring people there. I don't have, you know, really that much physical evidence to produce, to put in front of somebody. So I'm not sure I would believe the story either, and, you know, what can I say?
That's the bottom line, George, is, as you well know, when people ask for some support and you give them support, like you just said, well, here, everyone said he did work at Los Alamos. Here, I proved that he did. I've met people that worked there with him. You got his name there in the phone book. Eventually, you found out his Z number and that he actually did work at Los Alamos. You bring them along. You give them. Then they go, okay, well, what about this? And you prove the next step. Well, what about this? And it's never ending. You never reach a point where they go, okay, I believe it now. They want you to be able to lay it out and prove it like you could in court. Well, if you could do that, you would be talking to them anyway. You know, each
right.
individual thinks it's our burden to prove it to them. And so, like Bob, I mean, I don't even try anymore. I mean, I know what I know. And you notice, look, as you pointed out before, this is 17 years later. Look, without Bob, since Bob got out of the program, I don't know any more about UFOs than the next guy does. I just know what happened with him that back then, and I believe it because of the things he shared with me. But you can't prove it, and so why would we be trying two decades down the road?
Well, one of the things that recently caused this to all be stirred up again was the creation of a tiny portion of Element 115 by scientists. And, of course, this is what you said was the fuel for these alien craft. The scientific community around the world was able to create other elements around 115, and finally got a little bit of 115. But, you know, your supporters said, well, look, it really does exist. Your critics say, hey, this 115 isn't like anything like what Bob said it was like. It only lasted for microseconds. It's tiny little amounts. Lazar claims there was 500 pounds of this stuff up there. What, help me understand, why this the creation of 115 by our scientists, how it relates to your story? Does it add to it? Does it detract from it? And if it's not stable as what you described, how do you explain that?
Well, both sides are actually correct to some degree. It is something I said was possible, and that the craft operated on and, you know, did in fact exist, and, you know, at the time it didn't. So, yeah, they did prove that it can be made, and it does exist. However, it doesn't. What they created didn't have all the properties of the material that I described, and the reason for that is there are elements and different isotopes of those elements. To use hydrogen, for example, hydrogen has three isotopes. Hydrogen that we're familiar with, you can call protium. It's the typical hydrogen gas. Another form of hydrogen is deuterium, which is what heavy water is made from. Another form of hydrogen is tritium, and this is a radioactive gas, where the other two aren't. So each one of these has slightly different properties.
Because of what?
More neutrons. Yeah, it's the number of protons in an atom define what that atom is. For instance, an atom with one proton is hydrogen. An atom with, six.
Well, I won't put you on the spot.
I'm trying to remember now.
What's tritium?
Well, you know, 16 protons is oxygen. And as long as you have the same number of protons in the nucleus of the atom, if you add different numbers of neutrons to it, it still is that element, but it becomes a different isotope of that element and can have different properties. For instance, an ice cube made with deuterium oxide will sink in water.
So in other words, the version of 115 that's been synthesized, that was created by these scientists, maybe not just a good shot, good try for a first time.
It's certainly 115. It's certainly 115. They made four atoms of it, I believe, and detected them as they went through the detectors. But they also detected a rapid decay. But just like hydrogen has an isotope that undergoes radioactive decay, it also has stable isotopes. So, yeah, they simply didn't make the isotope of element 115 that we were dealing with. So I'm sure continued experimentation will reveal it. As long as they keep doing this, eventually they'll come up with a proper isotope, and it's going to have the properties that I claim.
Am I correct in remembering it this way, but weren't you guys, the two of you, were contacted by this heavy ion research lab in I think it was in Germany, the same guys who are working on this thing?
Darmstadt, yeah.
Yeah, that
Darmstadt.
Was a long time ago. I hardly remember what that was about. But, yeah, at the time, I think they were trying to synthesize it, and
I thought they did. I thought they actually made an atom or two of it about 10 years ago, which is why I was surprised.
No, I think they made 1.7 now.
But the lesson is that they actually took you seriously on it.
Yeah, apparently so.
Okay, we're going to take another short break. We'll be back with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff, and we'll be taking your questions. And we'll open up the phone lines. I'm George Knapp in for Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening, everyone. Thanks for sticking with us here, having a fascinating conversation with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. Our phone lines are open. They'll be taking your questions in just a couple of minutes. We've got an hour left with them, or about 50 minutes, and we'll try to get to as many of your calls as we can. In the meantime, Bob, I have one other question, and I'm almost reluctant to ask this because the guy I'm going to mention here, he and his group really thrive on any kind of attention they get, even negative attention. His name is Dan Burrish. Back when I first encountered him, his name is Dan Crane. He claims to be Dr. Dan Burrish and got his PhD while holding down a full-time job in Las Vegas, apparently by traveling to New York, State University of New York, Stony Brook, on weekends to get a PhD in genetics. And it's kind of a wild story. Now, I don't want to mischaracterize his story, because when word came that you were going to be on the program and that I might ask questions about you, someone sent out an email and modified it under my name and said a lot of nasty things about Dan. So he and his group are pretty much going off anticipating that they're going to get slimed. I don't want to do any slime.
Sliming. Who is this guy?
I had told you about him before. I interviewed you about him before. He has a story about that he worked out at the program basically at the same time that you were there. His job as a biologist was to interact with this alien named J-Rod, who's kept in a clean room facility that's below where the saucers are at S4.
I remember you mentioning something about that. And he claimed he worked with me. And
well, he didn't know you. No, he doesn't claim that he knew you. He just was in the program at the same time, but he was far more trusted of an employee, since he got to interact with J-Rod the alien on a regular basis, and they became pretty good friends. I just in a general sense, does any of this ring true?
Bill, I mean, I've never heard of this guy. No, and an alien named J-Rod, I've heard those stories from
Bob. Bill Uhouse, the old gentleman
right,
that used to work on the missile project.
Yeah, that's the guy that used to talk about that.
Yeah, he was the one that said the gray alien's name was J-Rod. Bob never said that.
Yeah, I know. Well, the Burrish and his crowd have sort of borrowed a lot of little bits and pieces from all kinds of UFO stories. I think they work for not only Majestic 12, but there's a battle between the Magi and the Illuminati. And you find any of this credible? And I don't mean to mischaracterize it. Okay.
No.
This, well, you know,
sounds
what?
Like the typical silly UFO lore you hear all the time.
Okay, well, we've probably spent more time on that than it deserves, and we're going to start taking some calls now. We'll go to our East of the Rockies line, Mike in Binghamton, New York. Mike, what's on your mind?
Hey, gentlemen, how are you?
Good evening.
It's a great privilege to speak with all of you. This actually is a little story I have to tell Bob. My father was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, and after he retired, we were taking a trip to Virginia to visit my brother, who works for a big computer company out in Seattle. We won't say who. We got talking about UFOs, and I mentioned Bob's name, and he got kind of like, how do you know that name? And I'm like, well, it's on all History Channel, and it's on Discovery Channel, and they have, you know, all kinds of television programs about UFOs, and Bob's name comes up a lot, and they show all his, you know, things, you know, that he's been talking about. And boy, he got so nervous, and he was like looking at me like, oh my gosh, and then I started bringing up Stanton Friedman, and he got even more freaked out. And, you know, it was rather disturbing that, you know, this is my father, and I mentioned Bob's name, and he was like, he got all shaky and nervous. And, it just makes me stop to think, you know, Bob, your story, I totally believe you. I 100%, you know, I have no doubts that, you know, the government is doing what they're doing and just not telling us.
Well, that's certainly a strange story, but I've actually heard other people say similar things.
Did you ever ask your father, did you probe to find out why that was his reaction? Or,
well, yeah, and once we got to Virginia, I started asking him Preston Nichols, you know, Preston Nichols and the Montauk experiments and all that stuff, and he like got all freaked out, and he's like, how do you know about all this stuff? And it's like, look, I study this stuff, you know. I just got done reading Brian Greene's The Elegant Universe. I kind of do, you know, read a lot of physics and stuff on my own, and, you know, quantum mechanics and stuff, trying to learn more about it. And then I told him, I says, well, I also read this book called The Day After Roswell by Colonel Philip Corso. And my God, the second I mentioned his name, my dad was like, he was like, all right, let's just stop talking about this. This is freaking me out.
Hey, thanks, Mike. And we appreciate the call. We're going to move along. We appreciate the call and the story, and maybe we can ask your dad to call us one of these days. We're going to go to a wild card line, number one, Kathy in Western Massachusetts. She's up pretty late this morning. Kathy, what's on your mind?
Yes, I am. Good morning. My situation with the government was local, on a local level. It was quite different than Bob Lazar, and it was not as serious. But believe me, I do believe you, Mr. Lazar, totally. After what I went through on my level, the government, when you're trying to bring something public and you do that, they do harass you, they do follow you, and they do try to discredit you, and they will try to destroy you. So I do understand what you've been through, and it is quite a situation to go through in life. But, you know, they the more they intimidate you, the stronger you get, I think.
Well, that's what people say, but I don't know. It gets pretty tiresome, you know. I thought this stuff was pretty much over with. We're talking about, you know, events that occurred, you know, we're coming up on 20 years. This is ridiculous. And
mine was a 20-year history also, and it's quite ongoing. And the more I push this, push the subject, the more I go public or the more I try to get it into court, the more trouble I get into. And the phone calls are very harassing, very threatening.
What was it that happened to you?
Kathy, you're going to have to hold the story because...
What I found out about a hospital, I was quite naive when I went into this, and it turned out to be that they practically destroyed me.
Kathy, I'm going to have to thank you for your story, for your call, but we need to take a short break right now. We'll be right back with more calls, more of your calls for Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. I'm George Knapp in for Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp, in for Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. We're taking your calls for Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. Let's go to our first-time caller line, Patrick in New Mexico. Patrick, fire away.
Thank you, George. You're doing a wonderful job. Bob Lazar, I knew Bob Lazar in San Antonio, but I really appreciate listening to you. You're very intelligent. But the reason I'm calling is I want to discuss Indian Springs Air Force Base. I was my father was stationed there in 56 and 57. Mm-hmm. And when they were doing the above and below ground testing behind Mercury Mountain there.
Mm-hmm.
And... 56, and when I was 54, I was the epitome of health. Now I've got three types of cancers. I'm going into my second aneurysm surgery this week. My teeth are falling out. And I just wanted to ask you the question as to whether you knew anything about whether the government knew that 40 years later the radiation. See, we used to be out in the desert. My friends and I, we'd have these car hoods, you know, where cars would run down the arroyos there, and mm-hmm. we'd take the car hoods off, and we'd see the wave coming, and we'd hold the car hood up to see if we could hold it up. Sometimes we could, sometimes we couldn't.
Kidding me.
No, I swear to God. Oh, and one interesting thing about UFOs, when we would go out and we would use those car hoods as a tent at night, we'd build a little fire in front of the car hood, you know, so snakes wouldn't come in, but we would sit out in front of the fire, and I remember, we knew nothing, I was a kid, you know, we knew nothing about UFOs, and I remember several times at night, this round object would come over us all the time, and we'd look up and go, look at that plane, it doesn't even have wings on it, you know?
Are you saying you surfed the shock wave from the explosion?
That's what I was harping on, too.
several times. My sisters had 28 surgeries. Yeah, they used to, when the shockwave would come, several times they would send, it would blow the windows out on the base housing across the highway from the base, and they would send these paddy wagons out, and within an hour all the windows would be replaced. You know, I swear to you, they would have all the women and children that, of course we would always be out in the desert, but they'd have all the women and children go into the bathroom so the if the blast came, the glass wouldn't cut them, you know.
In Indian Springs.
Apparently you've ignored the cardinal rule, which is never stand near an exploding atomic bomb.
Well, I mean, it was behind Mercury Mountain. You couldn't see it go off, you know. I mean, all you saw was just the wave coming. Oh, you'd see the cloud maybe behind the mountain when it sometimes, but... Not very often, but you just see the wave coming towards
you.
We didn't know anything. Heck, I was born in 51, and this was in 56 and 57, you know.
I really even doubt that the government was that familiar with the long-term effects of radiation
right.
at that point, just judging on how they treated their own people and, you know, the limited amount of information.
Look at the atomic cannon when they get ready to charge after the wind blew past, you know. So
there are a lot of interesting stories that I've heard about that Indian Springs base. It was there before Area 51 was created. I've been told that some of the technology, recovered technology, had been stored there before it was transferred to Groom Lake. Some real interesting stories that you hear about the base. Patrick, thank you very much for calling. We're going to go now to our wild card line. Bob in North Hollywood, are you there?
Yeah, hi, this is Bob from North Hollywood. Hi, Bob Lazar.
Hi there.
Hi. It's funny. I used to work on a cell fighter project, and I'll just ask you a few quick questions just for my curiosity about your background. You're aware that the Aurora project does exist, is that correct?
You're kind of choppy there. Are you on a cell phone or something?
Sorry, I'll clear it up. I'm sure that's better now. Are you aware of the existence of the Aurora project?
Yeah, I've heard it mentioned several times, and one time officially, from what I understood, is that it was a supposedly a replacement for the SR-71, a high-altitude, high-performance reconnaissance aircraft.
You didn't ever see it, though, did you, Bob?
I saw one thing taxiing out on Area 51 at one point, and you remember John Andrews for the Testers Model Corporation. He was always intimately familiar with military aircraft, and I drew him a sketch of the plane because I saw it, the closest view I had from it as we were driving by was a rear view of it. And I drew it for him, and I think the guy Jim Goodall, who is intimately familiar with aircraft and the SR-71 and all sorts of spy planes, in fact, even wrote a couple of books, and both those guys had mentioned, well, maybe that's Aurora, but maybe it wasn't. But anyway, that's all I know about it.
Bob, if I remember correctly, didn't you say that the sound of the engines was so loud it sounded like a perpetual explosion?
Yeah, it sounded like, in fact, I think the word I said was it sounded like the air was ripping. It was a really unusual sound and, yeah, incredibly sharp and, explosive sounding, I guess you can say.
That may or may not have been the Aurora. Bob, what was your other question? Bob in Hollywood, what was your other question?
I'm impressed. That's correct. If you know, the tester's model that was released of the F-117A before the F-117A was released was actually the Aurora. If you've seen the model, that's what the Aurora looked like.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it's pretty close. We called it, we nicknamed it the Wedge and the Dorito at first. And
so you were involved with this project?
I left just as the beginning of the project was starting, and the engine works on a hydrogen system. Are you aware of the hydrogen system the engine's using? I was just curious.
Well, hydrogen and methane, yeah, because that's kind of a pseudo scramjet then, right? Because you have supersonic flow in the engine.
That's correct. Yeah, it what most people would call it is a pulsing. It pulses.
Uh huh.
Did that too. We figured out a way how to nullify the gravitational forces by pulsing the engine. And the one part that I did work on was to the cockpit area that keeps the pilot from being crushed from the G-forces.
So is this a reconnaissance aircraft? Is that really what it is, or do you have...
It was a replaced SR-71. We started flying them first in 92. And they're going to declassify it within 8 years from now. They're going to declassify it to the public.
Jeez, they're in no hurry.
No. We need to replace it. Our new replacement we're coming up with is a different type of propulsion system that looks like a saucer. The next one we're replacing. Are you familiar with the next generation called Next Gen, which we're going to replace the Aurora with?
No, I've never even heard that term in relation to an aircraft before.
Okay, and that's similar to what you say you're working at Area 51. Do you know the correct term? Because we have a nickname for Area 51. Do you know the correct term that we use for it?
I've heard so many different ones from it. You know, I don't know if if they just make up different names or some of it is, I've heard scorecard. I've heard...
the box, the ranch, streamlined.
The ranch, yeah, that's what I was trying to pull up. I've heard so many. I don't. What did you have? You heard a new one, or
no?
Call it something different.
Yeah, there's a few. Yeah, actually, I was just testing you a little bit. Yeah, most of the people, well, we call it the ranch, basically. And there's other little nicknames, but just little groups of people call it different things. I've just seen which you're close to. Anyway, one of the biggest things I want to bring up right now is that this is going to sound really strange. If Bob Lazar's story is weird enough, but are you aware that we do have in our custody what we term is space aliens? We have them, and we're actually using them. We're actually large corporations like 3M. We're actually charging $250,000 an hour to have them structure a business. It's really bizarre, but we are doing that. We've been making money off these.
What makes you believe that?
They're proficient
businessmen.
Who
told that to you? And you know that was so convincing. You have to agree. It sounds crazy, right? So why, you know, what did anybody present any evidence to you, or, you know, what makes you think that's true?
There is evidence. The reason why I'm bringing it up is because we had a meeting. We're bringing what we call, it's a space alien. It's an individual who we have working on some of our projects because their ability to think outside the box.
What's he look like?
I can't go there. But the thing is that...
Now, wait a second. You already told us that we've got aliens and they're consulting major corporations. You can't tell us what they look like?
No, it's just something that really no one wants to really discuss. They're not that big. Well, anyway, there is I'll tell you right now, the Supreme Court, if you look in the Supreme Court, there's a lawsuit filed. A major corporation had paid $250,000 for an hour visit with one of the space aliens. A news reporter leaked out the story, and a news reporter was waiting for a space alien to arrive at this corporation, and it's in the Supreme Court files. You can look at it. Supreme Court, there was a lawsuit filed against U.S. government because they charged $250,000 an hour for a meeting of a space alien, and the reporter blew it in the security. Everything fell apart.
Where do you, how do you employ him? How do you retain him? Is he in the Yellow Pages under space aliens, or how do you get a hold of him?
Military contracts. If you know, if you're... military generals and stuff that have contacts with certain corporations that supply, what do you call exotic materials for the projects. To say some of the projects like Bob was working on, it was an exotic project which needed certain materials from certain companies. And, they would actually have used one of these individuals. They call them, I'm not saying it's a real space alien, but they call them a space alien. And it could be a biological robot, it could be a machine. I'm not going to really get into detail about it, but this device for this individual has the ability of an IQ, it's over 200, of an IQ of over 200. So you can imagine what kind of power that is for any corporation.
Hey, Bob in North Hollywood, thanks for the call. That's a very interesting story. We're going to take a short break right now. Yeah, I guess you would say a guy, if it's a space alien, would think out of the box, wouldn't he, by definition? Maybe Art Bell, when he gets back and could get the $250,000 together and have that alien sit in as a co-host one night, that'd be a pretty good show. More questions? Yeah, more questions for Bob Lazar and Gene Huff when we return to Coast to Coast AM in just a moment. Josh in Las Vegas on the wild card line. Josh, you're a hometown guy. We got to give you a shot here. What's on your mind?
And I'll tell you something. This is a great pleasure having Bob Lazar, Gene Huff, and the great George Knapp together for this great session. I'm enjoying it thoroughly. Bob, I feel like I know you. I moved to Vegas in 91. Sometime in 94, I traipsed into like a mom-and-pop type video store and came across your video and was pretty taken aback by it. I wound up, you know, looking to join MUFON. I talked to Glenn Campbell, stuff like that. But anyway, Bob, I have the utmost respect for you. I believe your story. I truly do. I guess my question is, if you know, you don't want to talk about it anymore, you just kind of want it to go away, but you actually made a video. You came out and made a video. And
The video wasn't exactly, because the video was intended to stop me from talking about it. At the time in the 80s, all I was doing was getting tons and tons of phone calls for interviews, and this is just something I wanted to get away from, and it would be just so much easier to put one complete interview on tape and hand it out to the people that wanted to, you know, wanted an interview and be done with it. And that was the original intention of the tape.
I'm just curious what substance is the story about Dennis, your boss, your former boss, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
Chasing you around downtown, like through the Union Plaza, things like that. I mean, is this to this?
You kind of cut out there for a second.
Meaning, is it a real story? Is there proof of it? And I think
With that particular story, Gene just happened to be there at that time. The whole Union Plaza thing,
right.
And Gene can tell you what he saw. We went down there as per Dennis's instructions, and go ahead, Gene, tell him what you saw.
Well, you know, just as an observation, for instance, you know, Bob approached this guy to talk to him, and the guy walked right by him and didn't stop and talk to Bob with a strange look on his face, as though we thought maybe Dennis was being followed.
And I guess that's possible. So Dennis Mariani went over to the blackjack table. And now it's a Saturday night in Las Vegas. And a telling thing is this guy sat in a chair with two beautiful women on each side of him. Low-cut tops, you know, Saturday night, they're drinking in Las Vegas. This guy sits down to play blackjack, and he doesn't look to his left. He doesn't look to his right. He's looking down to his cards and nowhere else. Just to kill time and play blackjack, Bob walked right up to him to start strike up a conversation. He tried to get rid of Bob. Bob came over to me and said, I'm going to try one more time to go talk. We turn around. Dennis has gotten up and is speeding out of the casino, and so the meeting never took place. But the whole atmosphere there, it seemed like Dennis Mariani must have seen someone following him because, I mean, he looked exactly like Bob described him. I mean, you know, I could tell that was Dennis Mariani, but even while calling for a meeting with Bob and being told to meet down there, he just wouldn't talk, and he left in a hurry, so someone else must have been there besides Dennis Mariani.
Yeah, we certainly suspected that it happened, and as it turned out, this was apparently some ruse to get us out of the house, because subsequent to that, when we got back to my place, something of importance pertaining to all this was missing. So,
right.
All that stuff is true. And there were, you know, my friends of that time, the people that were close to me at that time, were all involved with this. And, you know, they went through this with me. And some of them had rough times. Some were investigated by the IRS. I had one friend that was attempting to get clearance to, work for the government. And he lost that. And the reason given was his involvement with me, and the people around me were exposed to all this stuff. So although I can't present physical evidence, there are witnesses to some of these events here and there as they occurred at that time.
I can also tell you that I made a lot of effort to try to find Dennis Mariani, if that was his real name. I did find one gentleman an address in Palmdale, which is an interesting town if you think about it in relation to this kind of stuff, but was never able to find Dennis Mariani himself. Josh, is that it? Okay, Josh is gone, so we've got Roy on our West of the Rockies line. Roy, you still there?
You betcha.
What's on your mind?
I happen to know the individual that took Bob when he got fired. And I know on a previous program, Bob said he mentioned 28 people that he knew at Area 51, and Denny took him down when he got fired. Do you remember Denny, Bob?
Well, when I got fired, are you talking about when I went to
the morning
Indian
you got,
Springs to the
morning you got the morning you were taken down when you got fired? Remember that individual took you down there?
Well, they never really fired me. I mean, it was just never a call to come back. I mean, there was no official firing. The only time I was ever taken anywhere was during the debriefing after Gene Huff and friends were all caught out there.
His name was Benny, and he was a long-haired Paiute Indian. Remember him?
No, I never saw
Paiute. Where are you
Indian.
Suggesting he was taken to?
Well, I don't remember where he went, but he mentioned on a previous program a couple of years ago, about 3 years ago now, that he knew 28 people at Area 51, and he said Benny took him down when he got relieved or debriefed, and I called up Danny, and he said, yeah, he said, I told him he was talking too much, he should keep his mouth shut.
Probably that's too hard for
you to remember, but anyhow, I do know, it was mentioned earlier in the program, one called J-Rod, I've been able to communicate with him and his brother Crilly, and I do have a video of him that was sold on Art Bell's program in 1997.
There was a video sold of...
Yep, on Coast to Coast. I have a copy of it. J-Rod and Crilly, his brother. J-Rod was the one that crashed at Roswell in 1947 out on the desert, and he had 12 aboard.
It was an alien, and he was on the Art Bell show?
Well, the video was presented by a guy called Victor, put out by Rocket Pictures in California.
Victor Martinez?
I don't know what his last name was because he didn't identify himself. He used a voice alteration device to cover his voice. He didn't say who he was other than he just used this alias name. But I've got the whole video. I've got J-Rod's picture. I've got Crilly's picture. And I've also got a picture of their sister.
What do they look like?
About 3 foot tall, black, big black eyes, covers over their eyes. All the technology we got was gotten from them. Area 51 and every place else, our computers, technology, fax machines, cell phones, all since 1947. Even the phone lines we're talking over today. I've been working with them for 3 years.
Well, Roy, that's an interesting, that raises some interesting possibilities.
I've got the job to open the door on all of the secrecy.
Who hired you?
Them. Damn. The ETs.
How much do you make?
I'm $9,000 in debt right now. I've got material to put together, about 129,000 words to put into two books. My father lives on another planet 700 light years from here.
Uh-huh. You better get busy
for that.
Hey, Roy, thank you for the call. We need to take a short break here, and we'll be right back with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff and your final couple of calls. So stick around on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening, everyone. You're back with George Knapp filling in for Art Bell on Coast to Coast Live. We have a few minutes left with Bob Lazar and Gene Huff. We have Eric in Georgia on our East of the Rockies line. Eric, are you still there?
Oh, I'm here. How's it going, guys?
Okay, right, what's on your mind?
Honored to be talking to you. It's 5 a.m. here. I'm going to fall asleep like you almost did earlier, Bob. yeah, I'll try to make this quick. One of the previous calls, you were talking about names for Area 51. Well, I came up with something here. It's AFFTC Detachment 3, but I think it's something to do with Edwards Air Force Base. I think they have something to do with, like, running some of the things that go on at Groom Lake. I don't know.
I never heard that designation for
it's
it before.
It's like a Air Force Flight Test Center Detachment 3.
Hmm. I think that's the first time I've heard that mentioned. I don't recall it ever being referred to by that.
It's popped up in some of the literature over the years. I think Glenn Campbell dug up some information on that. They believe that some of the programs that were conducted out of Groom Lake were under the auspices of that attachment, that group.
And also, I email Stan Friedman and Bill Hamilton on a pretty regular basis, and what I get from them is that they're pretty damn confused on you, you know, like a lot of people are, but I mean, I just wanted to mention that. And also, have you heard about what's called a TR-3B, like flying triangle, that's supposedly nuclear-powered and also uses, like, superheated mercury plasma?
No.
That's the Black Manta.
Yeah, they were seen, like, over Belgium in the late 80s, I believe.
Hmm, you've heard of this, George?
That's rumored to be one of the craft that's been tested out there over years. I don't think anybody's confirmed the existence of it. A lot of folks, some of the aviation writers, believe it's it doesn't really exist, but it's a story that keeps popping up.
Mercury is a fuel? Is that what
you're... Yeah, there's some kind of... I'm not too technical, but it was kind of like a superheated mercury plasma ring underneath the craft, and it was triangle-shaped, and it also uses some kind of nuclear power, and it's completely silent, but it was tracked something similar to it in Belgium. 1989 on radar, the contact and everything. But
I remember hearing about the Belgian sightings.
Yeah, those were the same triangle type craft. Anyways, the real beef of what I called was, and I might actually get in trouble for this, but I've got a family member who works for EG&G, and he's got a top secret clearance. And sorry, I'm a bit nervous. He actually flew spy missions over Japan and Russia way back, and he's working on a lot of stuff, and of course he can't tell me the details, but I did manage to ask him about you, and he just said that he doesn't think there was any way he could, you know, go on TV and say the things you said without going to jail.
Well, if he went to jail, wouldn't that prove what he said had validity?
But that's exactly what I told him. But
it's a catch-22 type of deal. There's
right.
You know, you mentioned Stan Friedman, and of course, Stan has been very critical of Bob all the way along, which is fine. You know, that's fine. And what I do give credit to Stan for actually doing some of the work. I mean, you know, a lot of the material that's come out about Bob, people follow it up and they say, aha, there's no evidence he was at MIT. Aha, Caltech, same kind of thing. Those facts were all reported in the very first story we ever did about Bob on the air. I do give Stanton Friedman credit for following up himself. I know that he, one of the things that he says that he dug up was he went to your high school and talked to somebody and they said you were a terrible student and you could never get into MIT. Of course, the school denies ever giving out that information and no one will confirm it. So I would suspect that if the shoe were on the other foot, Stanton would not accept that as evidence, but he has in your case.
However, yeah, George,
really,
you know,
it's really strange.
I have a lot of respect for Stanton Friedman for some of the things he's done, you know, for ufology historically. However, with regard to Bob's story, as you well know, when he heard Bob had worked at Los Alamos, he picked up a phone, called Los Alamos, said, does Bob Lazar work there? Somebody said no, and he said, well, that's it. Bob Lazar never worked at Los Alamos, and went on the record. And then, of course, you provided the phone book and other evidence that Bob, you know, worked at Los Alamos, not for Los Alamos. But he was totally willing to give up and get negative before he had done anything more than make a phone call back then. Now, maybe he proceeded to do other research, but at first, he that was a very half-hearted investigation.
Eric, anything else from you there? Eric is gone. You know, speaking of Los Alamos, it reminds me of, I spent 2 years going back and forth with those guys. At first, they told me that Bob had never been there. I kept pestering them, tried to get it in writing. They finally said, okay, yeah, they came up with a Z number after I showed them his name in the phone book and the newspaper article listing him as a physicist. Then concentrated sort of on Kirkmeyer, which is the company that recruited you to work there, right, Bob?
That's correct. Yeah, that's who first got me out of Fairchild Electronics in California.
When I first contacted Kirkmeyer, they said, we've got the records, no problem, we'll be glad to give it to you, and then I didn't hear from them. I started phoning them on a regular basis, and they put me off. I have a stack of letters that we wrote back and forth to them, and after a couple of months of doing this, back and forth, they said, no, the records no longer exist. So, you know, that was sort of the problems that I faced all the way through this investigation. And, you know, I know there are people in the audience listening who don't believe it, they don't buy it, but there are strange parts of the story like that that are difficult to explain any other way, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and you're leaving out a plethora of other things, you know, down to the Social Security number and the, employer ID number, and I mean, all kinds of things, the physical things that I could put forward. But, everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but please don't pretend to know more about my life than I do. You know, these things really did occur. If, you know, you don't believe that, that's absolutely fine with me, and like I said, I'd actually prefer you maintain that. But, this is the way it is.
We just have a couple of minutes left here. Gene, why don't you tell us what you've got going, a couple of writing projects that you're working on, and then we'll ask the same question of Bob.
All right. I'm researching a book, basically. I told Bob about a chapter I was writing last week, and he wanted to make a T-shirt. And the chapter in the book was, I'm already ashamed to be an American. Let's stop this before I'm actually afraid to be an American. And what this is all about is I'm trying to examine, you know, anyone you question who travels abroad today, if they're sitting in an airport lounge, whatever, overseas, no one even wants to admit or bring attention to the fact that they're an American citizen because they feel like they're a target. So I'm just examining how we got to this point, you know, why it's at this point, and maybe how we can prevent this from being perpetuated into the future.
Well, you have to let us know when that book comes out. And Bob, the same question to you. What's in store for you? I guess the most obvious one is you're waiting to see what happens with this, the possibility of legal charges, right?
Yeah, that is. But, both my wife and I try and prevent that from dominating our mind. We're very busy with United Nuclear, which has turned into quite a big business. In fact, we're just finishing construction on our new facility, and we'll be producing and manufacturing all kinds of different scientific equipment and materials. So this is keeping us busy most of the time. I'm still, actively planning on releasing hydrogen system kits. And, you know, though it's kind of difficult, we're just looking for ways around the regulations that are apparently in place. And, you know, I assume I'll eventually be able to do this. The systems work quite well. The hydrogen generator is a little slow, so the process you use to make your own fuel needs improvement. But still, you know, things do work well, and there just has to be some common ground or some loopholes we can get through so we can legally sell this material without all the red tape. And, you know, it's something that I hope the people realize that are trying to prevent this from occurring. It's something that they'll benefit from, too. You know, this is something really that helps everybody.
Bob Lazar and Gene Huff, great to talk to you guys. Thanks for staying up so late. Thanks to all the callers who called in with their questions and stuck it out for all these hours. Thanks also to Art Bell for allowing me to sit in, and to George Norrie, all the staff at Premier Radio, and Lisa, the producer at down there with the Coast to Coast program, for giving me this shot. I'm George Knapp, signing off on Coast to Coast. Art Bell will be back on April 15th. Thanks, everybody.